fails, the minutes are adopted. Our next item of business is House File 1315. Welcome to the committee, Representative Purcell. I will move House File 1315 be recommended to be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Purcell, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. I'm delighted to be before you, my first committee that I don't also serve on, to present House File 1315, labeling of compostable packaging. The goal of this bill is to increase transparency and update law regarding labeling of plastic bags, which already exists, which is statute 325E.046, which already exists, but to update that so that this is a truth in labeling and it applies to all food packaging, not just bags. It prohibits food packaging from being labeled as biodegradable or compostable until an ASTM, American Society for Testing and Materials, an international standards organization, until that standard is adopted and the product can be certified as compliant and ultimately reduce contamination we've seen too often in our composting facilities. I'm hopeful that this bill will work to build our precious soil instead of putting harmful microplastics into it. And I would argue that our topsoil is one of our most precious resources. I continue to be in conversation with the Minnesota Grocers Association and other groups who want to make sure grocery or convenience stores would not be liable unless they knowingly carry and sold and sell the products as compostable. And the Minnesota Compost Council has already created a compostable products webpage to help with education. However, I am open to suggestions around the possible need to dedicate funds for an educational campaign to consumers. And I believe we have testifiers, Mr. Chair.
We do. First, we have Kelly Kish. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
All righty, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Kelly Kish. I am the chair of the Minnesota Composting Council, a statewide nonprofit dedicated to supporting and advancing the composting industry here in the state. And we urge you to support this bill today. It's crucial for the success of residential and commercial composting programs and also to meet Minnesota's recycling and composting goals. As was already pointed out, the bill only allows for third-party certified products that meet the ASTM D6400 or D6868 standards to be labeled as compostable in the state. And the truth is those are the only products that the composters in Minnesota will accept because they know it is not going to break down into microplastics in their systems. Minnesota cities, counties, and composters do a great job of educating residents and businesses of what items are accepted in the composting programs. However, retailers and distributors often trust manufacturers' claims, many of which are false, which is why we're here, and don't do any additional vetting of the products they sell to food or that food establishments put on their shelves. So it is crucial that we as a state do everything possible to help reduce this confusion for residents and businesses to help reduce contamination ending up at composting sites. Only by having clean material coming into their facilities can composters make a quality sellable product. And if we don't fix or address some of these, you know, potential contaminants now, composters may have to make the choice to not accept any food packaging whatsoever. This happened actually just this week in the state of Colorado. Their largest composter is no longer accepting any food packaging and is going to food scraps only. And we know in Minnesota that, one, accepting food packaging helps more food get composted, but accepting both of those materials are necessary to meet state recycling and composting goals. So if Minnesota composters are forced to make the same decision and no longer accept food service packaging, this would be detrimental to our farmers who sell their material to be made into compostable products, to compostable product manufacturers both in Minnesota and across the country, to residents and businesses who will now have to dispose of this material from the trash, and then, of course, our stadiums, businesses, and public events that are seeking to be zero waste. Our Minnesota Composting Council does already have a webpage for retailers and distributors to be checking their products against to make sure that they will meet the requirements of this bill. And after its passage, we intend on creating many more educational materials, providing them to the Minnesota Chamber, the Grocers Association, Retailers Association, local business associations, distributors, and more. And then two other quick things I want to point out. One is that there is an existing law around labeling of compostable plastic bags, and they've never issued a single citation. The PCA, when they do receive complaints of a non-compliant item, all they do is they work with that retailer or distributor to get that item off the shelves again so we can help reduce contamination ending up at compost sites. The goal here is not to fine, it is to help them come into compliance with the law. And then one last thing, there are some of the comments that you may have seen in written testimony are referencing the FTC's green guides. And those guides alone are general labeling suggestions for manufacturers. There is no science behind the green guides. And in their guidance document itself, it states that for products to be labeled as compostable, they need to have a competent and reliable scientific evidence that the materials will break down within a certain time frame. The updates to the green guides that some of the opponents of this bill are saying we should wait until those are updated, those updates do not negate the need for this bill to help our composters continue to produce quality sellable materials from our compostable feedstocks. And with that, I will thank you for your time. I will stay around if there are any questions. And I, again, encourage you to vote in support of House File 1315.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Chuck Joswiak. Come forward, state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Chuck Joswiak, and I'm here on behalf of Specialized Environmental Technologies, the largest composting operator in Minnesota. SET diverted 44 million pounds of discarded food and compostable food service items to our compost processing last year alone, along with 250,000 cubic yards of yard and leaf waste. I am also a board member on the Minnesota Composting Council and chair of the Operators Committee. HF 1315 is strictly aimed to curb greenwashing of terms on products for sale and keep non-compostable contamination out of compost sites by clearly identifying products that meet specific standards. It won't eliminate contamination, but it aims to reduce it. Terms such as biodegradable, environmentally friendly, natural, eco-friendly, oxo-degradable, and soil or marine degradable all sound like green options, but tend to confuse consumers when purchasing more expensive bio-based products. Since these terms are not regulated, consumers are left to decipher how they should be discarded and often assume that they can also be composted. For instance, our opponents want you to believe that marine degradable products should be allowed for sale in Minnesota, even though saltwater environments don't exist here. This end-use messaging suggests that it could be disposed of in our 10,000 lakes and rivers and still be okay for the environment. Some also want you to allow cups or lids that biodegrade over 86% in 7.9 years when tested under simulated, wetter, or biologically active conditions that may or may not be available in your state or area. It is essential to properly identify items that are compostable because that term is clear and concise and in its end-use systems of disposal. Our opponents will also tell you that standards from other countries should be allowed. This is because these standards are more relaxed and offer wider ranges of acceptability due to how they test. All Minnesota composters have been proactive about limiting potential microplastics and protective coatings like PFAS into their systems. They have refused to accept these overseas standards, so consumers are ultimately buying products that end up in other waste streams than composting. This bill only wants to delay using other claims of degradability until there are proven ASTM standards acceptable by all interested parties, and the intent and life disposal options are outlined in those packages. All Minnesota composters currently require third-party BPI certification of products that meet specific ASTM D6400 and D6868 standards within certain time frames and in specific composting environments. This is because they can control and replicate those composting processes unlike other natural environments that will vary significantly across the globe. Achieving 100% breakdown with no residuals in 90 days can be done here in Minnesota, even with temperatures like we have today or throughout the winter months. Composters are at a tipping point, and unless products are easily identifiable, they will soon be forced to refuse legitimate compostable products due to the significant amount of contamination that often accompanies them. Transitioning to food-only collection programs has been a national trend that will eventually have significant impacts on Minnesota companies manufacturing PLA products. It will also affect farmers selling these products to these local manufacturers. I urge you all to support this legislation to make sure that consumers, sellers, and composters know what they are purchasing, selling, and receiving. Removing actual bio-based compostable products from the composting process would directly contradict and inhibit the state from reaching its future diversion and recycling goals. Thank you for your time, and I'll stick around for any other questions as well.
Thank you, Mr. Joswack. I'm sorry, got your name wrong there at the outset. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify to this bill? Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed your testimony. Whoever gets there first, race, go. Oh, okay, Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Johnson, Senator Purcell and I have been following each other around for most of the afternoon. Mr. Chairman, my name for the record is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to thank you for the opportunity to make a couple of comments on House File 1315. Mr. Chairman, we're just trying to find consistency and clarity with other states that have passed laws regarding biodegradable and compostable labeling. New York, Washington, Maryland, and California have all passed laws around these labeling areas, and all of them make reference to the TUV Austria VinCot, which is standard, which is the European standard that was just referenced. The state of Washington also uses the Federal Trade Commission Green Guides, which is also recommended by the U.S. Compost Council, Mr. Chairman, and they state in their labeling guidelines that labeling of products, packaging, and sale materials or websites for products sold in the United States shall comply with the pertinent U.S. regulation guidelines, including the Federal Trade Commission's guidelines for use of environmental marketing claims, or the Green Guides, that clearly qualifies products as suitable for composting in commercial composting facilities. So that's right from the U.S. Composting Council. Also, Mr. Chairman, I think there's some duplication in the bill that if you meet those ASTM standards, those are enforced by the Pollution Control Agency Commissioner, as well as, upon request, the Attorney General. So it seems to be duplicative after you meet those standards enforced by the PCA Commissioner, as well as the Attorney General, if requested, that then go have to get certified from a nonprofit. So it just seems duplicative. Mr. Chairman, and then the final point, Representative Purcell referenced it. I think a beneficial addition would be an educational component in regards to single-use plastics. If something's in a box and on a shelf at a retail establishment, you're going to see the label, and that's going to help the consumer make that decision. But when you're in a single-use situation, whether it be a straw, a lid, a utensil, I think that an excellent value would be an education component, whether that's implemented by the PCA, the counties, or Minnesota WasteWise, which is an affiliate of the chamber, or some combination thereof, I think would be beneficial, Mr. Chairman, to be added to this. Look forward to working with Representative Purcell. She's been very good about having conversations with me about my concerns and addressing those as we move through the process, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Tom Johnson, Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'll keep it brief, Mr. Chair, since Ms. Kish and Mr. Joswack captured the most critical pieces of this legislation, most notably that it will help the state meet compost and recycling goals and will provide clarity to manufacturers about labeling requirements across the state. The MPCA has worked closely with the Composting Council, and we really appreciate Representative Purcell for bringing this back forward this session. It was previously an item in the governor's bill, and the MPCA is very supportive of the effort still to this day. So thank you for the opportunity to testify. Happy to stand for questions about enforcement or any of those other ways that the bill will be implemented. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. All right. Discussion to the bill. Members wishing to discuss the bill. Representative Katiza Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Purcell, for bringing this bill forward. As a consumer, the current status of these labels is extremely confusing to me. We've done home composting, which, you know, you can't compost a lot of the stuff that's only compostable in industrial facilities, and now we have an organics recycling process that comes to our home via our local trash company. And so we try to do what we can. But I know, like, every time I come home from a restaurant with a to-go cup or something, I have to, like, look it on the bottom. I'm looking everywhere trying to figure out whether or not I can put it in the organics recycling bin. And so I think that this would bring a lot of clarity to consumers who are trying to do the right thing. And I do appreciate that there is kind of an extended timeline here, so it's not until 2026. I know I was looking at the grocer's letter about selling through a lot of products that, you know, have already been ordered. They've already been packaged. Potentially, they're moving through. And you know, the last thing that we want to do is cause an undue burden when things are still safe to use, safe to eat, this sort of thing. And so I think that those are really both good points. And it sounds like, you know, you're having conversations with stakeholders. And you know, I look forward to supporting this bill down the line.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Purcell, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that I get to be the carrier of this bill this time around. It has been around and bipartisan before my time here, before my 11 weeks in this place. I'm really grateful to the people who know a lot more about this issue than I, and I'm grateful for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. I will renew my motion that House File 1315 be recommended to be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And House File 1315 is recommended to be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Purcell. Next, we will move to House File 1176, which is authored by Representative Ryer, but Representative Liebling will be presenting the bill very ably today. Representative Liebling, would you like to move the bill on behalf of Representative Ryer?
I would, Mr. Chair, and then I have an A2 amendment, which is just a technical amendment to put the bill in the correct form.
All right. So Representative Liebling moves House File 1176 be recommended to be placed on the General Register, and also moves the A2 amendment, which is an author's amendment. Any discussion to the A2? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. A2 is adopted. Representative Liebling to the bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as you heard, this is actually Representative Ryer's bill, so I'm pleased to stand in for her tonight. She's done a lot of work on dental care and with dentists, and this is a dentist's bill. It's just about transparency for dentists, and so I'm just going to turn it over to the testifier here, and he can explain more about the bill.
Wonderful. I think we have Dr. Tim Holland. Dr. Holland, please proceed.
Thank you, and good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Tim Holland, and I am the president of the Minnesota Dental Association and a practicing dentist in Owatonna. I am a general dentist and have practiced in Owatonna for 26 years. On behalf of our organization, I thank you for providing me with an opportunity to testify on House File 1176. This legislation addresses three critical aspects of the dentist-dental plan relationship. First and foremost, House File 1176 amends existing Minnesota law related to the disclosure of fees by a health plan to a provider. Currently, health plans must provide a full fee schedule in addition to other contract provisions before requiring a provider to sign a contract. However, dental plans are noticeably exempt from such a disclosure. This presents an interesting dynamic in that dental providers today are asked to enter into contracts with limited information on expected reimbursement for services to be rendered under such a contract. No other business transaction would be conceived without the full disclosure of terms, conditions, and fees associated with such a transaction. House File 1176 eliminates this exemption and applies the current contract disclosure statute equally to health plans, inclusive of dental plans. A second important provision addresses concerns associated with methods of reimbursement employed by some dental plans. Of particular concern is when a dental plan provides reimbursement using virtual credit cards, cards that often impose fees in order to collect payment for the service the dentist has provided the patient. Fees associated with these cards range from 2 to 5%, and essentially require a provider to pay in order to get paid for a service. Several dentists have reported that some payers afford no other method by which to receive reimbursement. The provision does not prohibit the use of virtual credit cards or any specific means of reimbursement. It merely provides for full transparency in payment method, and more importantly, affords the provider an option of reimbursement which does not incur fees. It ensures that at least one method of payment is provided that does not impose a fee in order to obtain payment from the plan. The third important provision in House File 1176 addresses network leasing, a practice where a dental plan leases its provider network to another entity, which is often an unrelated dental plan. This frequently occurs without any notice to the contracted dentist. This practice results in confusion for both patients and dentists. For the dentist, they may unwillingly be required to comply with contract terms and payments that may differ from the original contract. Patients may be confronted with a dental practice that has no knowledge of what may be covered by the patient's plan, which leads to a potential disruption in the delivery of care. The bill's language simply ensures the disclosure by dental plans to a provider of any network lease arrangement. Such disclosures would include any variations in the contract obligation and fees. It further and most importantly provides the dentist or dental practice an opportunity to opt out of such a leasing arrangement without penalty. This bill was heard last session and was included in the final Jobs, Economic Development, and Commerce Conference Committee report. The language in this bill has not changed since that time. Furthermore, the language is the result of discussion and collaboration from last session between our organization and Delta Dental of Minnesota, one of our state's largest dental plan providers. Input was also received from the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I urge you to support this bill and help bring transparency and fairness to dental plan contracting. Thank you for hearing this important piece of legislation, and I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Dr. Holland. Next, we have Patrick Hines. Mr. Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Patrick Hines with Messerly and Kramer. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Dental Service Organizations, or DSOs. DSOs provide a lot of administrative, billing, scheduling, and other back-of-the-house services to allow dentists like Dr. Holland to provide excellent patient care and to focus on their patients. We are here in support of this bill. I would have thanked Representative Ryer if she were here, but I'll thank Representative Liebing on her behalf. I won't repeat the testimony of Dr. Holland. I will say that while this might not be the most exciting and high-profile bill passed by the House Commerce Committee this year, it will make a difference for dentists and it will make a difference for patients, and we thank you for giving it the time.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify to this bill? Seeing none, discussion to the bill. Closing comments, Representative Liebling?
Thank you for hearing the bill.
And with that, Representative Liebling renews her motion that House File 1176, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and House File 1176, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the General Register. The next item on the agenda is House File 1132, which is also from Representative Ryer. But today we will have Chair Lee presenting the bill. Did I say the wrong number? I said 11. I meant 1532. I will move House File 1532 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Lee, to the bill.
Thank you, Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to present House File 1532 on behalf of Representative Ryer. So this bill is proposed to address dog breed-based barriers in making determinations about homeowner and renter insurance policies. The result of breed-based barriers is that consumers are either underinsured, left with questions about why they've been denied and what options do they have, or forced to relinquish their beloved family dog in pursuit of coverage. And so the bill will help ensure the insurance industry use objective facts to determine whether an individual dog poses a risk. The bill prohibits insurer from refusing to issue or renew an insurance policy or a contract, canceling an insurance policy or contract, or charging or imposing an increased premium rate. for an insurance policy or contract based solely on the fact that the homeowner harbors or owns a dog of a specific breed or mixture of breeds. The bill creates an exception if the dog is designated as a dangerous or potentially dangerous dog under Section 347.50 or based on sound underwriting and actuary principles that are reasonably related to actual or anticipated loss experience. The bill is effective August 1st, 2023. And Mr. Chair and members, I want to note that the National Council of Insurance Legislators, a legislative organization comprised of insurance stakeholders, also have model language that's similar to this bill. And so with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
All right. And we have Shannon Glenn. Ms. Glenn, please state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Stevenson and members of the committee, my name is Shannon Glenn, and I'm the executive director of My Pit Bulls Family. We're a national nonprofit organization that is based in North Minneapolis with a focus to keep families together by advancing dog-inclusive rental and insurance policies and providing essential pet retention programming. I have to say that this hearing is 7 years in the making, and I want to extend a special thank you to our authors and to the committee for allowing us to bring this bill forward. I'm also honored to be sitting next to my representative, as he knows that this is something I'm passionate about, and as I struggle to find insurance that would accept my two blocky-headed dogs. Imagine being faced with a choice to give up your home or your beloved pet. It seems unimaginable. Yet many Minnesotans are facing this decision every year, and the reason for this is a commonplace issue. The insurance industry uses arbitrary dog breed lists and deny homeowners and renters insurance coverage that discriminates against individuals. Housing continues to be the number one reason why dogs are surrendered across the country. According to the 24 Pet Watch January 2018 through September 2020 owner surrender data, where taxpayer dollars are being then utilized to care for amazing dogs that have families that love them during their stay in shelters. According to the AVMA, 35.5% of households in Minnesota have at least one dog, meaning that this legislation potentially impacts over 807,000 households across the state, depending on the type of dog that they have. We strongly believe that when it comes to the regulation of pet dogs, the focus should and must be on the behavior of the individual dog and owner. Arbitrary restrictions based on a dog's weight, size, or perceived breed do nothing to promote public safety. Worse, these restrictions are almost always based in misinformation, myths, misinterpretations, and are steeped in discrimination against the people society associates with the targeted dogs, most commonly low-income communities and BIPOC individuals. According to the Insurance Information Institute, lovingly known as III, a property damage including wind and hail, fire and lightning, water damage, theft, and any other property damage is responsible for an average of 96.98% of the losses incurred by homeowners insurance from 2014 to 2018. Also, according to III, liability claims related to dog bites and other dog-related injuries cost homeowner insurers $796.8 million in 2019. In 2019, property casualty insurance companies wrote $634 billion in premiums and incurred $374 billion in losses. Based on the information above, dog bites and all other dog-related incidents, even as small of an incident as tripping over a leash, accounted for less than 0.2% of losses in 2019. It's important to note that under the provisions of this bill, as Representative Lee said, insurance companies can still require additional coverage, premiums, or stop existing coverage due to a dog being declared dangerous or potentially dangerous due to the state statute. This common sense legislation will put the focus on where it belongs, the behavior of individual pets, and the responsibility of owners, and is also supported by NCOIL. They passed the model language in November 18th, 2022. On behalf of families across the state and the country who are searching for a place to call home with their family dog, I thank you for your time and your consideration of this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Lynn. Next, we will hear from Aaron Cocking. Mr. Cocking.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Aaron Cocking, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'm here tonight to testify in opposition to House File 1532. As this committee will hear me say multiple times during this evening's hearing, we object to the state telling insurers what risks they must take, especially in non-mandated lines of coverage. Homeowners insurance policies provide liability coverage that can pay claims related to dog bites. Each year, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, dogs bite more than 4.5 million people in the United States, most of them children. Over the last 10 years, the average dog bite claim has jumped almost 50% to more than $50,000, all while being able to exclude the most vicious and costly breeds of dog. In 2017, dog bites accounted for one-third of all homeowners' liability claims, costing almost $700 million nationwide. Now, that's a significant chunk of change. Eliminating an insurer's ability to underwrite based on dog breed will lead many insurers to exclude coverage for dog bites altogether. This means dog owners of all breeds will be on the hook personally for any medical, legal, or other expenses a victim incurs because of a dog bite. That $700 million cost will now be borne by individuals, not insurers. And why? So that owners of the most statistically dangerous and statistically expensive breeds of dogs can obtain coverage. In 2019, there were 59 fatalities in the United States from dog attacks. 69% of them were from pit bulls, despite pit bulls making up only 8% of the total U.S. dog population. Now, insurers should not have to wait for a potentially devastating personal injury or death before deciding whether to provide coverage or continue offering coverage. Let's look at this another way. Most insurers decline to write houses with solid fuel heating sources such as wood stoves. Is it because every wood stove will cause a house fire? Of course not. However, solid heating fuel sources are more likely to lead to fires than other furnaces. So most insurers have made the decision to not write them, to keep their risk of loss down for their rate-paying policyholders. This is the same way for dog breeds. At the very least, the Minnesota legislature should wait for the results of a study currently underway in Illinois to determine the scope of the problem. In 2021, the Illinois legislature, faced with a very similar issue, passed a law that required insurance companies that write homeowners insurance in the state to report to the best of their ability all dog bite claims in the state. The required information includes the breed of the dog, where the owner obtained the dog from, the sex of the dog, and whether it was spayed or neutered, whether or not the person was teasing, tormenting, injuring, or otherwise provoking the dog, the type of injury that was sustained by the victim, whether the injury occurred on the insured's property or at another location, and whether the dog had received any sort of obedience training or there had been previous claims or past complaints against the dog. I think that's all relevant information. The two-year study will report its first update on July 1st of this year. And at that point, this legislature can make a decision based on actual numbers and data. Now, I fully understand how attached people are to their pets. However, that cannot blind us to the fact that some breeds of dogs are a greater risk than others. If people want to have those types of dog in their house, be my guest. But don't then mandate that an insurer has to bear the cost of that risky decision. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cocking. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, member discussion to the bill. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lee, I wanted to start by trying to understand a little bit better how the prohibition and the exceptions work together. And in particular, I'm trying to understand what it means that what the difference is between taking some action based solely on the fact that a homeowner harbors or owns a specific breed or mixture of dogs, or in the exception where it's permitted that the insurer is permitted to take actions, quote, based on sound underwriting and actuarial principles that are reasonably related to actual or anticipated loss experience. So specifically, my question is about the APCIA letter in our packet that says that individual insurers might be able to apply actuarial principles or sound underwriting principles to distinguish between breeds of dogs. Would that be permitted under the bill if it were passed?
And Chair Lee, you know, I do understand that we asked you to pinch hit on this bill late in the day today. So I'll give you the opportunity to answer the question if you'd like. We can also see if House Research has thoughts on it. But Perhaps since the bill is being laid over also, that maybe that's also a conversation that Representative Niska could have offline. But Chair Lee, if you want to answer the question, I'd certainly give you the opportunity.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for the question. Like the Chair noted, very late in the day to speak on this, and so if nonpartisan staff could address any piece of that, that would be greatly appreciated.
Ms. Pompeo.
Sure, Chair and members. My interpretation is that it would have to have some kind of actuarial principle. It couldn't just be a change in rate not based on underlying data.
And Representative Niska, I'm sure Representative Ryer would be happy to discuss this with you in greater detail at another time as well. And the bill's being laid over. But Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I see we have another guest at the
We do, but do you have a question that you want to ask somebody?
Well, I was in,
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if the guest was someone who was hoping to weigh in on this. For the record, I think it would be helpful if there was someone who could provide it.
Mr. More Miners, detail. If you want to identify yourself for the record, and if you have an answer to Representative Niska's question, you may go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Stevenson, and Representative Niska. For the record, my name is Zach Eichton. I am the.
I'm sorry.
The Minnesota State Director for the Humane Society of the United States. Thank you for the question. So one of the things to your question about actuarial data is right now just sort of the blanket breed bans isn't based in any actuarial data. So that would be something that we would be really expecting to come out once this is in place to be able to actually come back with real data that would address this. But right now the way that the breed list work, that's not actually based in any actuarial science, so that's why we have that in here. And I would also kind of defer to NCOIL a little bit on that language, just because they're the experts, and this was based that sentence was based on their model language.
Thank you, Mr. Eichton, and I apologize for totally making up a name for you, apparently. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that was, I think, actually a pretty helpful context for the record. I think that my understanding of this, of the way this bill would work, is that this would create a situation in which insurers would be able to have garner some sound underwriting and actuarial principles that go to this question. My other question, though, if I may, Mr. Chair, to ask Representative Lee, is whether the bill would permit an insurer to cancel insurance outright for a dog bite, or stop offering any dog bite coverage in the state of Minnesota if they decide that the costs are too high.
Chair Lee, again, I will give you the first opportunity, but if you'd like me to direct that question elsewhere, I'm happy to do so.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to defer it to Mr. Eichton, please.
Mr. Eichton, do you have an answer to that question?
Yes, thank you, Chair Stevenson and Representative Niska, for the question. Under the exception, starting on line 1.11 through 1.16, we do already have dangerous dog statutes that are really well-defined. So if there was an incident with a very specific dog, then yes, that would be an option for an insurance carrier to not renew that contract. But what this is saying is dog breed is not the same as dog deed, so you wouldn't be able to make that determination based off of just a general breed of dog, but rather the very specific dog that is under the coverage.
Anything else, Representative Niska?
Oh, that's all.
All right, Representative Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and you know, as I read Subdivision 1 and Subdivision 2, it's very clear that the first subdivision talks about breeds and the second one talks about experience with an individual animal or with an individual dog. And I think that's very important to spell out, because my experience with the insurance industry is that the first dog bite is on the insurance company and there is no second dog bite, which is kind of interesting when you think about it. And the reason there's no second dog bite is that the insurance company will have canceled the individual because of the dog bite. It doesn't mean that because you have insurance that you're going to continue to be keeping that insurance. It means that because you have insurance for that unforeseen circumstance, that unforeseen situation, you would be given the opportunity to receive indemnification, either because of the liability of the animal that you own or because of a qualifying injury that you sustain, depending upon what the coverage is, not just specifically this. And so what I find kind of interesting is I went in and I looked at 347.5, and it all talks about the individual dog. For example, In this section, it says dangerous dog means a dog that has, without provocation, inflicted, past tense, substantial bodily harm, killed, past tense. And we see a lot of past tense in here. So to cite that the dog in the exceptions here, that's a little bit, I think, misleading, because the insurance company would go ahead and cancel. If the insurance company is not allowed to make a cancellation of that contract under this provision, it's simply going to drive up the premiums and the fees for all dog owners and all property owners at the expense, in providing that coverage at the expense of all policyholders. I suspect what we'll start to see in the state of Minnesota is insurance companies, because this is an optional coverage, choose not to do this or to completely just withdraw from the marketplace. And that's got some very undesirable consequences. For example, if the insurance company cancels the individual under their coverage, and an individual has been with that company for a long time, might have had multiple vehicles and other insurances with them, they're getting what is called most likely a multi-policy discount. Those will be canceled when that individual goes to buy coverage in another location or from another carrier in the state of Minnesota. And when they are asked for through the underwriting process, have you ever had insurance before? Yes. Have you ever been canceled? Yes. What was the reason for the cancellation? First thing that insurance company is going to say, oh, the dog that bit, is that dog still with you? Because if it is, they're going to take a pass on writing you coverage, which means that the premiums are going to go up even higher for individuals who are finding themselves in that situation. Now, again, I've went through an awful lot on this, and I'm thankful that the bill is going to be laid over so that perhaps we can address these issues and not create more uninsured situations that might occur as a result of this. And I think that maybe my colleague, Representative Farr, who's in the banking industry, may also talk a little bit about how that affects one's ability, if they're canceled, to be able to keep their home loan or mortgage in place as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I may have some questions later, but I wanted to go ahead and get some of these things off for discussion.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I appreciate the comments, Representative O'Driscoll. And so, you know, one of the concerns that I had there, if I understood Mr. Cocking, insurance company could just choose not to underwrite dogs altogether. That's a potential here, so that you wouldn't have dog coverage, or if you, in the case that Representative O'Driscoll is talking about, if you did and then had an issue, if your coverage is terminated and you have a mortgage on that on your living, your house, whatever it is, you're going to be forced placed with insurance that is going to be extremely expensive to have. So I'm struggling to find out how this is going to benefit Minnesotans. Again, it looks to me as though it's going to cost more to insure than less.
Further discussion? Seeing none.
I would like to use some final comments then, if I might.
If you have very, very brief final comments, we need to move on. The bill's being laid over. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, it's being laid over, but it's also probably going to have legs and maybe four legs, so to speak, because of the subject of this matter.
When that happens, so. When it comes back again, you will have an opportunity to speak again. And we are going to move on after very brief comments.
Mr. Chair, however, the other thing that I think is worth noting on here is it's not just a homeowner with a mortgage. It could be a renter who's in violation of terms and conditions of their rental agreement because they had a dog that has bitten, and we're just going to displace people from their homes. I really think that this bill needs some additional work and consideration, particularly since there's a strong desire to increase housing options for people, and we may just have to add these folks to the list if we don't think a little bit better about how to proceed with that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lee, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members for the discussion tonight. I really appreciate those feedback, and I'm sure that Representative Ryan will be willing to work with all members as the bill is being laid over. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lee, and with that, the bill is laid over. Now I'm going to move to the testifier table and ask Chair Liebling to take over up here.
Thank you. All right. Okay, the next bill on the agenda is House File 2249, Chair Stevenson. Would you like to move your bill to be laid over for possible inclusion?
I would make that motion.
All right. And did you want to move the A23 amendment right now?
Yes, please. I would move the A23.
Madam Chair, could we discuss the amendment prior to voting on it, please? I have some questions that might help us move the conversation along.
You know, usually it's my practice to just allow the author to put it in the shape they would like to have it. But Chair Stevenson, do you want to just mention what it does before we adopt it?
It is, as you said, an author's amendment that reflects some changes that are the result of some conversations that have happened between the stakeholders to this particular bill. If Representative Driscoll wants to ask further questions, I might invite Mr. Carlson to come down to the table as well.
All right. Well, Representative O'Driscoll, is this going to make a difference on you're going to vote against the amendment here? Or can we allow the I think it's a courtesy to allow the author to adopt the amendment.
But then if that's the case you want to do it, I'll just ask for a roll call vote on the amendment, then we can just proceed forward.
Well, okay. I mean, if it's that big of an issue, I guess we can go ahead and discuss it before
okay.
you.
Thank
before
you, Madam
we
Chair.
Adopt it, go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the bill author. Line 1.6 talks about deleting the word criminal from section 1.18 to 1.20. And I'm wondering why we were looking to delete the word criminal on here from the definition when it was originally in the bill.
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, if you could direct that question to Mr. Carlson while I left my paper up there, so I'm going to collect some.
All right. All right. Mr. Carlson, if you would please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead and address the question.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members. I'm Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, the reason criminal was deleted on 1.16 is that you could have a situation where someone was boating while intoxicated that would maybe be a criminal act that ordinarily on your vehicles wouldn't necessarily void the insurance for a third party that you may have liability to. So we took criminal out to clarify the statute, not to not to give an additional reason to exclude coverage. It was in there in the context of fraud, like someone was committing a criminal act of fraud, which are still excluded. But we didn't want to be so broad that if someone was speeding on a boat, which would be against the law, it's criminal, that would be an excuse to avoid coverage. So that's why it was deleted in this amendment. And we have, Madam Chair, we've had several conversations with the Insurance Federation to try and clean up areas of the bill. That was one of them that we suggested. We also cleaned up the language on 1.11 to clarify what prohibited exclusions really mean. We added in a provision on 1.19 to address the insurance industry's concerns about not making an umbrella policy primary when you don't have coverage on a lower policy. That's what's 1.19. And then we also added an effective date so that it would be prospective going forward and not impact policies that are currently in place. So that's the bulk of the amendment. It's been the result of many conversations with my friend Mr. Cocking, and they have been productive, and I appreciate them very much, and we're happy to answer more questions if you have them.
All right. Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, thank you. I was kind of thinking along those lines, and I'm just glad that we were, for the record, able to confirm that that's the reason we're doing it, and I certainly will have further comments once the bill is amended. We've had a chance to hear from testifiers.
All right.
Thank you.
So Representative Stevenson renews his motion to adopt the A23 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Stevenson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. You know, when I was growing up, my parents had a 1987 Forester inboard outboard speedboat. And in the summer, we'd spend many days on the Mississippi River between Champlain and Coon Rapids swimming, tubing, and water skiing. And I can remember very clearly one day sitting on the back of that boat, and I don't recall who was driving the boat, but my brother was about to go tubing, and he was on the tube out in the water. My dad was on the sun deck letting out the rope, and no one noticed that the rope had looped around his foot. And when whoever was driving accelerated, the rope snapped and would have pulled him into the water. Now, fortunately, he dove over the propeller and into the water. And he came up shaken but uninjured. He had felt the turbidity of the prop against his foot. It's, you know, pretty clear that he was feet, if not inches, away from a life-changing injury or possibly worse. I was maybe 12 when this happened, and so insurance wasn't really on the forefront of my mind at the time. But I remember talking to my dad about this bill back when I first carried it in 2019, and I asked him about this case, and I asked him if he had insurance on that boat, and he said, oh yeah, absolutely, always insure all of my vehicles, boats or otherwise. And I asked him, if the prop had hit your foot, would you have expected that you would have been covered by your insurance? And he said, I mean, absolutely, that's why you have insurance. Now, my parents sold that boat a long time ago, and the insurance policy is, I'm sure, long since been recycled or destroyed or whatever. But as it turns out, if Dad had been hit, the odds are his insurance policy would not have covered his injury. As it turns out, most boat insurance policies exclude liability coverage for the insured person, the boat owner, as well as people related to them by blood or marriage. And people might be surprised to learn that. I was certainly surprised when I first learned about this bill several years ago. This bill tries to get at this problem by prohibiting insurance companies from excluding people for coverage under boat policies just because they are related by blood or marriage. And this might seem like a common sense idea to you, and if you do feel that way, I suspect it's because this has been the law for car insurance since 1973 in the state of Minnesota. You know, I suspect that people who oppose this bill will argue that it will increase the cost of boat insurance. That could be true, but I doubt it. The bill does allow insurance companies to increase premiums if there's an increased cost, but they would have to show data, actuarial data, in order to the Commissioner of Commerce in order to do that. I also will note that we're not talking about that many accidents. Minnesota has 800,000 boats. I looked that up. That's the most of any state. And in an average year, we have less than 100 boat accidents. And we don't know how many of those accidents involve a family member of the boat owner, but it's probably safe to assume that that number is less than the 100. And in any event, as a person who owns a boat myself, I will tell you that I would gladly pay the marginal cost of increased coverage to ensure that my kids and my wife and myself are covered when we are out boating. And with that, Madam Chair, I know there are some testifiers, including one who has a very compelling story to share with the committee, and I would gladly turn over to them.
All right. Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Courtney Godfrey. Welcome to the committee. If you would please state your name for the record and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Hi. I'm used to being in front of a microphone, but this is different.
And do pull it close because the mics are not so wonderful.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Chair Stevenson and members of the committee, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak tonight. I see plenty of familiar faces who have heard my story before, and if you know me, you know I'm not going anywhere until I see a change. So you'll keep seeing me until we get this change. In 2017, I was involved in a boating accident that resulted in the amputation of my left leg. We were riding in my husband's 19-foot ski boat like we did most weekends in the summer, when a quick turn sent me flying out of my seat and into the water. My husband, an experienced boater, killed the engine as soon as he saw me go over, but it happened so quick. I felt the impact on my foot and knew I was hurt, but it wasn't until I surfaced, holding my foot out of the water to assess the damage, that I realized the propeller had sliced right through it. I'll never forget the pressure on my shoulders from my sister's hands as she told me not to look down. The panic in my husband's voice as he called 911, and the immense fear that came over me. None of our lives would ever be the same. A week later, I was released from the hospital pretty quickly. As you can imagine, the bills started piling up. Our home needed modifications. I was unable to work and in need of constant supervision and care. I had incredible health insurance through my employer at the time, but prosthetics are expensive. You would be blown away with what I have to pay every year for my legs. Needless to say, we were feeling more than just the physical pains of my trauma. Thankfully, though, my husband had been prepared. Always the responsible consumer, he had purchased boat insurance. An extra safeguard that surely would fill in the gaps, or so we thought, so anyone would think. Despite having full liability coverage on our boat, we were told that I was not covered for no other reason than the fact that we were married. Hugely disappointing, obviously, but thankfully he had also purchased an umbrella policy, just in case a scenario like this played out and something fell through the cracks with his other policies. He called the umbrella carrier to file a claim. The person on the other end of the phone told him the same thing as the last. A family exclusion, they called it, or quite simply, a marriage penalty. If the accident would have happened the summer before when we weren't husband and wife, this wouldn't have been the case. If this would have happened to, say, my sister who was on the boat that day, she would have been covered. Unlike with your auto liability coverage, like Representative Stevenson mentioned, this practice was outlawed for car insurance long ago. Neither your spouse nor your children are covered in your boat policy. Shocking news to me and to the everyday consumer. And I know that people are shocked when they learn this, because we started calling our friends to tell them to check their policies. Not one knew of the family exclusion. And all called their brokers to discover it was in their policies too. With boating season quickly approaching, I started spreading the word. I didn't want another family to go through this. But I could educate until I was blue in the face, and it still wasn't good enough. Because all I kept hearing from people all over Minnesota was that they couldn't find a policy that didn't exclude their spouse and children. While the idea of getting back on the water was painful, I've never been one to let my trauma control me. And now that I'm a mom to two beautiful little kids, I would never want to rob them of the joys of living here in the land of 10,000 lakes. My son, he loves to fish. He's only 3 and a half, but man, he loves to fish. And you should see him light up when his grandpa asked him if he wants to go out on the boat. But we've tried to find a plan. We activated an independent insurance agent to find us a policy that would cover my beautiful babies, and they can't. And yet I can tell you, I have come to the Capitol not for myself, not for any special interest group, but for the next family that endures such trauma, so that the insurance policy they faithfully paid into for however many years does what it's advertised to do, protect the people they care about most. Minnesota has one of the highest rates of boat ownership in the country. People of all incomes in every corner of this state own boats. And while according to the DNR, you heard Representative Stevenson say this, the occurrence of injury accidents on the water is relatively low, I won't be the last to go through this. Please, let's put an end to this unfair exclusion and protect Minnesota families on the water. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Joel Carlson. And then Jed Kronick after Mr. Carlson. Welcome back, and please reintroduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, Joel Carlson again for the Association for Justice, and I'll be very brief. I forgot one thing, Representative Driscoll, that was deleted in the A3 amendment. The provision about effect on premium cost, we deleted in the amendment after talking with the insurance industry and how that would work with their business. We deleted that. I failed to mention that. Madam Chair, members, this is an important issue for consumers. We believe that these exclusions for them are not disclosed, and that this is a way that we can help protect them. I share Ms. Godfrey's. I'm a boat owner, and I went and looked at mine as well, and they're different. They're all different, and you have to really look to find out if you do have the coverage. And consumers, many of whom are buying their insurance online right now, are just not giving it that kind of detail. So we hope that we can advance this bill, and rather than go through the bill again or tell you why we support it, I think it was compelling of why we're supporting this bill. I'm going to have Mr. Kronick, who's going to talk just a little bit about the details of the bill, Madam Chair, and then we'll be here to answer questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jed Kronick. I'm an attorney in Mankato and the legislative chair for the Minnesota Association for Justice. As you've heard, these exclusions serve to severely or completely eliminate coverage for insured's own family members and household members, the people the insured cares about the very most. As Mr. Carlson's talked about, we have worked with other stakeholders to try to work on compromise language. I think we've gotten pretty far on that. I think the language is pretty straightforward, so instead of, I guess, diving into the details, I will just offer that I'm happy to answer any questions, but I would urge passage of this bill.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Aaron Cocking. And then Gene Sudloff after him. All right. Welcome. Welcome back. Please reintroduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Aaron Cocking, President of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, here tonight to testify in opposition to House File 2249. First, as I stated on the previous bill, the IFM is opposed to the interference of insurers to offer the products and policies they desire, especially for non-mandated lines of insurance. And that's important because boat insurance is not mandated by the state. As I stated to the committee in my opening presentation in January, insurance is a contract between a policyholder and an insurer. They should be free to contract as they wish, especially in non-mandated lines of insurance. And part of that freedom is the insurer deciding what risks they want to write. And that is currently happening in the market. There are boat insurance policies in Minnesota today that do not include a family exclusion. These companies have developed the product, priced it accordingly, all without a law requiring them to do so. Now, one of the constant arguments we hear in support of that this issue is that the Minnesota Constitution guarantees injured parties redress for their injuries. And we could not agree more, and that's not in dispute. However, the Constitution does not guarantee access to a particular source of funds, such as an insurance policy. This is what this bill is attempting to do, to ensure that you can sue yourself with the insurer footing the bill. Liability insurance was never designed to provide first-person coverage. It is a third-party policy. The whole rationale for the family exclusion is to exempt the insurer from liability to persons whom the insured, on account of close family ties, as the court describes it, would be apt to be partial in case of an injury. Now, I recognize that that's a mouthful. Now, don't get me wrong. I understand that it would be unusual for a household or family member to purposefully injure another household or family member. But the possibility of being able to turn an unfortunate situation into a payment for the household income is a legitimate concern, not only in a situation where the cause of the accident is different from how it is reported, but in how evidence can be shared to enhance the amount of damages being sought. Consider the unfortunate situation where a married couple is enjoying a summer day out on the lake on their boat. And while the wife standing up to grab another drink, her spouse throws the throttle all the way forward, knocking her off her feet and causing her to break her leg. However, instead of this being an unfortunate situation, they quickly realize this injury will adversely impact the household budget because of lost time at work and other potentially significant out-of-pocket expenses. The spouses decide they can report the incident as resulting from the other spouse's careless acceleration of the throttle and then enable the family unit to sue itself. Moreover, since the spouses will be the chief damages witnesses in a trial, the spouses, quote, on account of close family ties, would be apt to be partial in a case of injury, again, as the court has said, to enhance their testimony to increase the amount of recovery, which would be funded by liability insurance under this bill. It is terrible public policy to place individuals in this moral hazard situation to incentivize the fabrication or even embellishment of the circumstances of an injury and extent of damages. The spouses together contribute to the common household family economic interest. We are turning a boat policy from a financial protection mechanism in the event you hurt someone else into a first party income source for the household family budget, so long as the household family fabricates or embellishes the cause or extent of an injury or the resulting damages. I touched on the issue of moral hazard before, but it's something I want to return to. It is terrible public policy to allow for or to incentivize a moral hazard. Moral hazard is a situation in which you bear no responsibility for your decisions. You have no ownership over the actions you take, which is exactly what would happen if this bill were to pass. Now, we have heard about auto insurance and how we should equate that to boat insurance in this scenario, and I just want to point out those are vastly different. Auto insurance is mandated in this state at minimum coverage limits that the legislature has established, which is why courts have upheld family exclusions in auto. Boats, again, stop me if you've heard this before, are non-mandated coverage. Now, on the amendment, we do think that the term criminal should remain in the bill. I think it's kind of absurd that in addition to allowing yourself to sue yourself, we will also allow a person to sue themselves for a criminal act. I would also encourage the committee to change the effective date on a more technical fashion. We have trouble getting policies approved by the Department of Commerce right now in a timely fashion, and I'm hoping that in your budget will contain money for additional staff. We just don't think that they're going to be able to get these policies approved by August 1st, and so I think January 1st, 2024 would be a better date if you were. I would reciprocate to Mr. Carlson, appreciate working with us on the amendment, make some improvements to the bill. However, because of the objections I have mentioned previously, I would certainly encourage folks to oppose the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair, and as always, I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Gene Sudloff. Welcome to the committee. If you would please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jean Sundloff. I've been an insurance agent for the last 43 years, and I'm here on behalf of the Big Eye, Minnesota. I have significant concerns about House File 2249. As insurance agents, we want to see our clients properly protected. I grew up in the insurance business, and I went into this business because I wanted to help people because of the satisfaction that we get from doing a good job and properly protecting our clients from catastrophic loss, whether they're consumers or businesses. However, as Mr. Cocking states, third-party liability policies are not the proper way to provide protection for first-party risks. There are other types of coverage that are intended for this purpose that are more appropriate, such as medical payments, uninsured voters, various other policies that are available. It's our job as agents to work with our clients and design the most appropriate coverages to protect them for their risk. I'm particularly concerned that this bill would open the door to various types of abuse. It would encourage fraud by providing an incentive for collusion. Fraud occurs in about 10% of the losses in our industry. According to the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud, it steals at least $308 billion every single year from American consumers. This coverage could motivate families in financial crisis to sue each other for financial gain, and this would thus make those families less desirable policyholders to the industry. It could provide coverage for claims arising from infighting among family members. And then the bill could allow a potentially negligent party to benefit from their own negligence. In many cases, the injured party and the policyholder against whom the claim is being made would have been jointly responsible for maintaining that property. Finally, forcing the industry to provide coverage for a risk with a high moral hazard may cause market contraction. It may cause increased premiums for all, or it could cause both. Raising premiums in a market where the purchase of insurance is entirely voluntary may price some consumers out of the marketplace, and that would leave less protection for more common types of claims that we see against these policies. I encourage you to vote no on HF 2249. I thank you so much for your time, and I'm available for questions.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on the bill? All right. I'm not seeing any, so we'll move to member discussion. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I have a question for Mr. Cocking, because I think you mentioned that there were some policies in Minnesota that provide this coverage. Is that correct?
Yes.
Mr. Cocking.
And
Madam Chair, Representative Kraft, that's correct.
So Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you went on about all this horrible things that would happen if we did this, and yet some policies do it, and it doesn't appear that calamities have happened. So I don't understand your that point.
Mr. Cocking.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Kraft, thanks for the question. You're right. I mean, the market, I guess, from our perspective, works. Those companies have figured out the risk that they're willing to bear and the price that they're willing to get for it, and have found a way to make it work. I think our concern is that what works for one company might not work for another, and that the beauty of why we have a competitive insurance market in the state of Minnesota is because companies have the ability to select the risk that they want and price for it accordingly.
Representative Kraft?
Yeah, I would just say thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Cocking, that the story we heard, and I think of others, doesn't indicate market success to me. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Stevenson. I wanted to see if you could address the effect of the deletion of the criminal permitted exclusion in the example that Mr. Cocking had given. And the reason I ask is because I found on my phone on a local TV news station's website an article about that the DNR said that half of deadly boating accidents in Minnesota each year involve alcohol. In 2020, it was 56% of boating fatalities in Minnesota involved alcohol. And, you know, Mr. Cocking said that means that someone driving the boat could be under the influence of alcohol, or maybe if House File 100 passes, they could be under the influence of something else and be driving the boat, and then essentially sue themselves, and the insurance company would not be able to exclude that from coverage. Is that accurate, how your bill would work?
Mr. Carlson. I'm sorry, it was...
If that's okay, Madam Chair, I'll
go ahead, please.
At least try and help walk through that. I mean, you know, when we first wrote this bill in 2019, Representative Niska, we were trying to address a fraud issue as criminal conduct that family members would invent claims. And that's why the word criminal was in there. But as we thought about it more, we thought that may be just an additional punishment and a way to exclude coverage because, as you noted, you know, you could have some, whether you're convicted or not, some element of a crime that would maybe be committed on your boat, whether it is, you know, being over the legal limit or driving too fast in an awake zone. You could have a situation where there's technically criminal conduct. So we left in intentional conduct to make sure that you certainly can't intend to injure anyone. But we took the word criminal out because that's not how it operates in the automobile space. And so we just didn't think that it made sense in the bill that a third party who your conduct has injured would be penalized because of your conduct, right? And you don't get to sue yourself. And if you look at the bill, you know that as a named insured, that you're not buying insurance to cover yourself for your, you know, for your own negligence. It's a third party who has the claim against you. The way the law operates in Minnesota, as you know, the only way you can get to that claim against your family member is to bring a case. We maybe have a discussion about bringing the case against the insurance company directly, but that's the only way. And suing yourself, we've had this law in Minnesota in the automobile space, and there are 35,000 or more automobile accidents in a year. This happens with some frequency in the auto space. We don't have people inventing claims. And by the way, it still has to be a claim, right? It still has to be a tort. Duty, breach, and harm. You still have to have all elements of a claim. You don't get to invent this as a source of income for your family. You have to have had a duty to your passenger on your boat. You had to have breached that duty. They had to be injured, and that injury is compensable through money damages. All of those things are still present here. We're not inventing any new rules where somehow your boat policy becomes you know, some source of income for your family, and it just doesn't happen that way.
Madam Chair, before we go back to
Representative Stevenson,
I have 30 seconds just to ask Mr. Carlson a question. I thought that was a quick question. Right. It was not. So I will address that with him later.
All right.
And I think
Mr. Carlson
wants to lay this over. And I do mean sincerely, we've had a number of productive conversations with the IFM to try and address their concerns. And so we'll dig down deeper on this question. We're not trying to protect someone for their criminal acts. To the same extent, though, we don't want to exclude a family member from coverage that you would have with a third person, because you could read that to be an exclusion for liability to third parties as too, and we don't want to do that as well. So we will dig down deeper in that issue on that topic.
All right, we have three other members on the list now. Anything further, Representative Niska?
And thank you, Madam Chair. Just one final comment, which is I think the root problem in terms of sorting this out is that we're trying to incorporate no-fault principles and required insurance principles into a third-party insurance context that I just don't think it really makes sense. And I think that's why we're struggling so much to understand how things where the insured is really at fault and it's their family member coming and trying to access that insurance policy, why we're having such a hard time making sense of that.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know that I necessarily have some questions, but I do have some observations for the benefit of the committee. The liability coverage that's under the property policy for boats does not mandate or carry no-fault insurance. No-fault insurance, as the bill author pointed out, was brought into the state of Minnesota some 50 years ago. But another policy out there that doesn't require no-fault insurance is motorcycle coverage. As I kind of ran a motorcycle incident through the same kind of a scenario that we did with a boat policy, two persons, husband and wife, kind of using the examples that we've heard today, are on a motorcycle. We hit a spot of sand, and one of them, the rider, is ejected from the motorcycle and sustains several injuries and the like. You know what? That person does not get coverage under that policy either, because it's liability and property damage of your actions to others. We have that same household exclusion that we have in the boat policy in motorcycle coverage. I wonder if we're going to be hearing that same kind of a scenario next year or next session or down the line and say, well, you know what? We did it in boats. We need to do it here in the arena of motorcycle coverage. And one of the things that's just really befuddling to me about insurance here in the state of Minnesota, particularly no-fault insurance, which is about 50 years in existence, we still have the same liability and property limits that we did and uninsured and underinsured limits that we did when that coverage is put into place 50 years ago. Half a century, 50 years ago. $30,000 of liability coverage per person for injuries sustained by a non-at-fault party outside the household, aggregated $60,000 and $10,000 of property damage. And in 50 years, we've never increased those limits. I did some checking on that over time, and you know why I found out? Because the fear is that if we raise those limits, we'll have more uninsured persons in the state of Minnesota, because that is a mandated coverage. I think the phone call to 911 costs $30,000 right now in today's marketplace. And again, if we are going to have a boat policy that provides this coverage in the scenario that we're talking about, and it works its way up into the umbrella policy, some of the comments that this side of the table has shared earlier are going to be the same case. You get one shot. You get canceled for that once-in-a-lifetime event, and you don't have the ability to get coverage, and if you do, it's going to cost you more. You're losing all of your other good credits as an insured if you have them with your company. I'm going to defer back to the comments that were made by my colleague, Representative Farr. You may not be able to get coverage. You may have a default in your mortgage and lose your home. And if you don't have renter's insurance, you may not be able to stay in your home or your apartment or your dwelling. There are consequences. Be fully aware of what we're walking into, members.
All right, we have a couple more members on the list. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Godfrey, I think you and I met a while ago back when I still had 10 fingers. And so I do understand how expensive those prosthetics are. And I also want to say that you don't always know what you have as far as your insurance. When this happened to me, same exact situation, except I was using a saw and I still haven't been able to use those. So I'm glad you were able to get back on a boat. But, you know, they asked, do you have accidental death and dismemberment? Checked with our HR here. Yeah, you have accidental death and dismemberment. So I'm thinking, okay, good. This is going to help me with daycare and that kind of stuff. And filed the policy. You have to cut your hand off at the wrist in order to get anything. And so it was really shocking. Even our HR department here didn't realize that was a policy. Luckily, we were able to change it for the CGIP employees. And so the next person to cut a finger off, I get a cut of that. But
no pun intended.
Yeah. But I just want to say that sometimes you think you have the coverage and you think you're aware of everything that you think you have your ducks in a row, and something pops up that really just kind of throws everything for a loop and changes your life forever. So, you know, it could have been worse, and I'm glad it wasn't. And I hope to be using a saw sometime this summer.
Thank you. Representative Cleborn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Stevenson, I want to say thank you for bringing this bill again. I remember the first time we heard it, I was stunned to realize that when you buy boat insurance, you really don't have insurance for your family members. We all know that when you're on a boat, things can happen that have absolutely nothing to do with you or anyone in your boat. Right? When you go on some of the lakes in Minnesota, other people speed and you fall out of your boat, right? And it has nothing to do with you, but you would be the one looking to figure out how you recover, right? To hear the tragedy that you shared with us today, thank you for sharing that painful story with us. And to think that in the worst moment of your life, you're now discovering what you thought you purchased isn't what you purchased. While we were listening to your testimony, I started scrolling on my phone, and you have to go several pages into advertisements for insurance, and then you have to know what you're looking for to discover that you're not covered. So I think we need to look at this in the bigger picture also to say if if an insurance agent is selling you something, they need to be very clear about what they're representing to you. And so if this bill does not prevail, and I hope that it does, then we also need to think about making sure that there are checklists that insurance agents need to tell you, you do realize this will not cover your family, before they accept your premium. So thank you again for bringing this forward. I understand there's personal responsibility in knowing what you buy, but there's also just common knowledge of what people think. And when you go into your insurance agent who has sold you your car insurance and has represented to you, this is what liability insurance means, this is what's going to happen if someone in your family is injured in your car, you would expect maybe something similar in your boat. And I understand the legal piece of it. I get it. I'm just talking about what the ordinary person expects when they buy liability insurance. And that's whose voice I'm talking about today. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Chair Stevenson, final comments.
Yeah, I think that when you synthesize the comments that Representative Kraft and Representative Cagle and Representative Cleavorn made here, you really get to the heart of part of the problem here. Representative Kraft points out that some policies have this and others do not. Representative Cagle and Cleavorn point out, and the world hasn't ended just because some of them have it, and then Representative Cagle and Cleavorn point out that it's often very difficult for the average consumer to know what's in their insurance policy, and looking into it at the point when you do it, usually too late. The other comment that I really wanted to make is, well, two things. One is I think that when we do come back, I think we will change the effective date. I think Mr. Cocking's point is well taken there. The second point I do want to make, and I'm going to channel Representative Niska here and use some legal terminology and say that the family exclusion is both over-inclusive and under-inclusive if the goal is to prevent fraud. It's over-inclusive because it excludes a lot of claims that are very clearly not fraudulent, like what my dad's claim would have been that I described or what Ms. Godfrey described. Those are not fraudulent claims, and they are excluded by a family exclusion, not for even any suspicion of fraud, but just because the people are related. It is under-inclusive because it doesn't exclude claims that probably are fraudulent. And I said this 4 years ago. I'm going to say it again. If I was going to commit insurance fraud, if I was doing insurance fraud, I would not do it with my wife. Who would sooner divorce me than be a party to insurance fraud. I would do it with my devious best friend, who frankly would probably be down for that. And the family exclusion would not protect the insurance company from a fraudulent conspiracy between my friend and myself. Nor, if you take the example that Mr. Cocking gave of the husband and wife on the boat with the drink, if you just change that to boyfriend and girlfriend, it does not change. Or if you change it to fiancé and fiancé, as would have been the case if Ms. Godfrey's accident happened a short time before when it actually did, it would not be covered by the fraud exception. Fraud doesn't hold up. This is a good bill.
All right. Thank you. And with that, Chair Stevenson renews the motion that House File 2249, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion, and the bill is laid over.
All right. Our next bill on the agenda is House File 2064 from Representative Tabke. Representative Tabke, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I recommend House File 2064 be recommended for. I move that House File 2064 be recommended for placement on the General Register.
Representative Tabke moves that House File 2064 be recommended to be placed in the General Register. Representative Tabke, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This is a pretty simple bill. Right now, in statute, we have a series of folks between state agencies, educational institutions, public schools, and other folks who are able to negotiate on their behalf with different pricing plans. And so with this, the bill adds tribal governments and tribal schools and tribal nation into the bill. And we have Mr. Kelly from Commerce here to explain further.
All right, Mr. Kelly, please state your name for the record. Proceed your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members. For the record, my name is John Kelly. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Thank you to Representative Tabke for carrying this important bill. This proposal provides tribal governments with the same ability to negotiate pricing plans as currently available to state government and other local units of government and political subdivisions in Minnesota Statutes 237.66. This proposal provides the legal right and recognition that tribal governments are not the same as other company customers, makes explicit that the law is to ensure the availability of high quality technologically advanced telecommunication services at reasonable cost to tribal governments. I would have got that out more smoothly if we had gone sooner. the addition of tribal governments under Minnesota Statutes 239.66 would authorize carriers to develop and offer telecommunication services specifically directed at serving the needs of tribal nations at a reasonable cost to tribal nations. This proposal serves tribal governments in the same manner as state government by obtaining pricing plans that are different from the standard tariff prices. Desire for better pricing alternatives was raised to the department by one of our 11 tribal nations, and so we are bringing it forward to make this change and bring parity in all of our governments in this section of Minnesota statutes relating to telecommunications. I'm available for any questions. Appreciate member support.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify to this bill? Member discussion to the bill. Closing comments to the bill. Representative Tabke.
It's a good bill. Please support it. Thank you.
All right. I will renew Representative Tabke's motion that House File 2064 be recommended placed on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 2064 is recommended to be placed on the general register. The next item on our agenda, last item on our agenda, is House File 1650 from Representative Davis. Representative Davis, welcome to the committee. I will move on your behalf. House File 1650 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Representative Davis, to your bill.
Thank you for that, Chair Stevenson. House File 1650 is the technical and housekeeping bill for the Department of Commerce. Section 216B.096 is the cold weather rule that applies to residential customers. The rule protects Minnesotans from having their electric or natural gas service shut off between October 1st and April 30th of the following year, granted that they have set up a payment plan with the utility company that is agreed upon by both parties. Under Subdivision 11, utilities have to submit a report in regard to the cold weather rule to the commission. This bill just modifies those reporting dates. The other part of the bill has to do with Section 237.55, modifying dates and clarifying some language for the Commissioner of Commerce to give reports on accessibility of telecommunications services to persons who have communication disabilities. And this bill comes at the request of the Department of Commerce, and I am pleased to see Mr. Kelly is here.
I'm also pleased to see Mr. Kelly. Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, I'm John Kelly. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. This important, extensive bill changes the reporting date for the Telecommunications Access Minnesota report from January 31st out into a later date in the year. The reason for this is that we don't receive the data until January 15th. It makes timely delivery of this report difficult for our staff. So this was included in the Commerce, Jobs, and Energy Omnibus last session that was left on the table. We're just trying to get this clarified and would appreciate the committee support.
Any members of the public wishing to testify to this bill? Seeing none, member discussion to the bill? Seeing none, closing comments to the bill?
We're good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, then I will renew my motion that House File 1650 be recommended to be placed on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 1650 is recommended to be placed on the general register. That's the end of our agenda. The meeting is adjourned.